This is Medical World News Second Opinion.
There's something that's been weighing on my mind, Rashmi. I really wanted to talk to you about
clinical situations, case studies, landmark findings. These docs have seen it all.
I'm always shooting my mouth off about some junk. I apologize, but I have to just say this.
Grab your cup of coffee and step into the ins and outs of daily routines of physician experts from around the country.
Probably the hottest topic, which I can't wait to get my hands on.
Sometimes we all need a second opinion.
Catch brand new episodes of Second Opinion every Tuesday and Thursday, only at medicalworldnews.com.
Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor for Neurology Live.
In this episode, we're going to recap the Consortium of Multiple Sclerosis Centers annual meeting by sharing some snippets of a number of conversations that we had with experts this week on the floor, which includes highlights of data presented at the meeting, as well as some hot topics of conversation. Some of you may remember this from our recent AAN episode. But without further ado, let's dive in. First up, we've got Dr. Riley Beauvais, an associate professor of neurology at the University of California, San Francisco, who spoke with us about the findings of a social media listening study that she and others conducted evaluating the conversations that women with MS are having online about disease-modifying therapies during and around the period of pregnancy. Here's Dr. Beauvais.
So we did social media listening, which sounds a little bit like sleuthing, but basically it involves going to publicly available websites like Tumblr, Reddit, things like this, and looking at posts that relate to pregnancy and multiple sclerosis, and then reviewing the posts for content. Are they questions? Are they information sharing? What's in the post? Is it about specific medications or specific concerns? And then finally analyzing those posts. We were looking at a few key things. One was, what stage is the person who's posting the information in, right? So we never know for sure if it's a real person or, you know, with all those caveats though, it seemed to be mostly female patients with MS who were either contemplating a pregnancy or currently pregnant or postpartum. And then we looked at kind of sentiment analysis, where the posts, was this overwhelming sentiment from the post, the gestalt, was that more positive, was it more negative? And then we looked for specific content, like, you know, what exactly were they posting about, whether it was a treatment or a breastfeeding question or something else. And I think it just reflects the state of the field, where for a long time these weren't considered truly legitimate questions, in the sense that pharma took a very road mapping approach to solving them. So for a lot of time, it was really up to individual investigators, perhaps supported by pharma, to kind of look at real world outcomes of the safety of these medications. And so we're now in a situation where some clinicians just go by the label, and the FDA and EMA labels are different sometimes and often, conflicting, and for the same drug class, there may be different recommendations. So you go by the labels, which are a little bit illogical, or go by based on super conservative recommendations, or go based on what we know, which is an evolving field. So it's very understandable that patients are getting a range of information from their clinicians, many of whom may not be experts at all in this arena, and they need more information. So some examples are patients who are told, let's say, not to breastfeed on a specific medication, but then they sleuth around a little bit, find out about some safety signal, and then talk to other patients, and they sort of find strength in numbers to go based on what they think as opposed to what they've been told by their neurologist.
Next up, we're going to hear from Dr. Blake Dewey, a postdoctoral fellow at Johns Hopkins MS Center, who spoke with us about the work that he and others are doing to allow for better incorporation into the clinic of spinal cord atrophy as a biomarker of disease progression for patients with MS. Here's Dr. Dewey with his thoughts.
Basically, what we're trying to do is expand how we can look at the spinal cord. So spinal cord imaging is for clinical use is traditionally a little bit thicker, and we're looking for very qualitative things. We're looking for lesions and the extent of those lesions and their position. These are all things that you can find very easily on clinically available scans. But when we talk about disease progression, some things that are on the horizon are like atrophy measurements. So brain atrophy has been very popular in terms of research measurements, and now spinal cord atrophy is also looking to be a very good indicator of progression. But the imaging that's required for spinal cord atrophy measurements takes a long time. It's almost never acquired clinically. And so what we wanted to do is take some of our research-acquired spinal cord scans that are very high resolution, very detailed, and compare the measurements that we get from them to a brain scan that actually includes the very top of the spinal cord to see if we can get similar measurements and similar correlations to progression measurements, to disease-related measurements. And so this is the very beginning of this study. So we're just looking to see, hey, can we get these same kind of measurements if we get a high-resolution brain scan, which we do very regularly. Almost all of our MS patients get them. What we know so far is that these measurements are very highly correlated. Very, very strongly correlated. There's actually been some publications now on it as well from other groups. So this has been replicated across a number of different sites. And in our presentation here, we did see that there was correlation with motor-based disease measurements, like things like the walking test and the nine-hole peg test, which is a dexterity test, and the expanded disease score. So we're hopeful that it's going to continue looking that way. And then since we're only at the baseline measurement, we can't say how it's going to translate to like a longitudinal measurement, but that's definitely where we're going, to see how atrophy and progression are correlated, and also how atrophy before we saw the patient, before they started this progressive trial, how that affects how they do in the trial. So what there tends to be is that we get a little bit of a lag before we can finally say that, yes, a patient really is progressive, especially when it comes to drug trials and clinical trials. The definition is very strict. What we're looking for is, are there ways that we can measure a patient's progression that is either quicker or earlier than these established progressive metrics, the EDSS, for instance, which is kind of the gold standard. Can we measure something in the spinal cord? We're also looking at other measurements that can tell us, oh, this patient looks like they're going to progress. We might need to follow them differently. We might need to manage their care differently. And when it comes to drug trials or clinical trials, maybe this patient might be eligible for this trial as a progressive patient, but they might not meet this more strict, possibly lagged EDSS-based criteria.
Now, shifting gears slightly, we're going to hear a bit of our conversation with Dr. Bruce Cree, a professor of clinical neurology at UCSF, whose voice you may remember from this very podcast recently, and who spoke with us about the latest data out of the N-Momentum study of inebilizumab for neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, and what the data revealed about the disease. Here's Dr. Cree.
So here the presentation was looking at genetic polymorphisms in the Fc gamma receptor, which is an important cell receptor that binds the constant domain of an antibody. And it has been found in anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies that deplete B cells that polymorphisms in this Fc gamma receptor reduce the efficacy in certain patients who carry a particular allele for activity against B cell depletion. So the study that was conducted and presented here at this meeting was looking at polymorphisms in the Fc gamma receptor in the context of the inebilizumab clinical trial and momentum in neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. And the purpose of the study was to determine whether there was any impact in terms of therapeutic efficacy of inebilizumab in patients who carry the Fc gamma receptor polymorphism. And the good news is that there wasn't, but some interesting observations were made. In individuals who carry not the allele that results in decreased anti-CD20 activity, but the other allele, we found that there was actually an increase in disease activity associated with that other allele. So suggesting that perhaps that allele mediates the negative effects of having anti-aquaporin 4 antibodies, right? So something involved in NMO pathogenesis. But the important point was is that this glycoengineered monoclonal antibody, inebilizumab's activity in terms of depleting B cells was robust. It worked well, regardless of the Fc gamma receptor polymorphism. And especially during the open label extension portion of the study, which began roughly 6 months into treatment, really one could see no real differences in terms of disease activity measurements in those individuals who carried the polymorphism that was being implicated to reduce B cell depletion with anti-CD20s in this inebilizumab treated cohort. There will be additional insights from N-Momentum. Several manuscripts are on their way. Hopefully we'll have some data on serum neurofilament light, which winds up correlating quite nicely with disability. So that can be potentially an added biomarker for determining how aggressive one should be at the time of an NMO clinical attack. And then we have our end of study manuscript hopefully coming out in the near future, as well as a deeper dive into what constitutes clinical attacks in NMO. So one of the things that we did with this study is we provided a priori a series of criteria, what we thought would constitute an NMO clinical attack. We set up a real-time adjudication committee for the clinical trial, and the committee worked well and was able to adjudicate clinical attacks in real time. But we also got serial MRI imaging on everybody. And so we have the MRI data, the serum GFAP data that we've talked about before. And so now what we're really trying to focus on is bringing all of this data together to, in an iterative process, to further delineate and define what constitutes an NMO attack. And I think with this data set, and it's the only one that we can do this in, we'll be able to use a combination of clinical criteria, radiographic criteria, and serum biomarkers of GFAP to determine what is an NMO attack. And I think that is going to be very useful for the community.
Now, we're going to hear from Dr. John DeLuca, the Senior Vice President for Research at the Kessler Foundation and a professor at Rutgers University Medical School, who shared his perspective on the goals of the ongoing ENLIGHTEN trial in MS and the role that cognition plays in the disease. Here's Dr. DeLuca.
So ENLIGHTEN is actually an interesting study. You know, most studies looking at cognitive dysfunction are from pharmaceutical companies do not look at cognition as the primary outcome. So it's always a secondary, tertiary outcome. It's not powered properly. ENLIGHTEN is one of the very few where cognition, cognitive processing speed, is the primary outcome. So that's really important because it increases the chances of actually finding something. And so ENLIGHTEN is ongoing. It's looking at cognitive processing speed. It's looking at MRI parameters of what atrophy in the brain, looking at a variety of patient-reported outcomes over a two-year period. And so it's going to be really enlightening, if you will, one of the few studies to really look at cognitive processing speed and the effects of Zeposia on processing speed. Cognition is a huge issue to the patients. It's one of their biggest complaints, one of their biggest fears. They don't want to lose their mind. So it's really a big fear. We have very good tools for assessing cognition. The assessment of cognition is not an issue. It's the use in clinics that's the issue. some of the most recent evidence shows that more than half of the clinics in North America don't even ask about cognition. And then if you ask about cognition, you're not even assessing it. So we have very good tools to assess cognition. That's not a problem. I think it needs to be, finally, 30 years ago, when I first started doing this work, neurologists said cognition was not a problem in MS. So today, at least we have that recognition. The National MS Society guidelines recommend annual, early and annual cognitive assessment of persons with MS, as well as early and annual assessment of depression. And part of the reason for that is we know that patient self-report of cognitive impairment does not necessarily reflect actual cognitive impairment. So the assessment becomes critical. And I know a lot of the times that I hear from neurologists that we just don't have the time for this. Well, I think we have to make the time for the patients. It's a really important problem for them. And if you can't do it in your regular sessions, schedule another session or refer out. It's not an issue of assessment. Now, with regard to treatment is another issue. There's really good data that cognitive rehabilitation can significantly improve cognitive rehabilitation. It's an area in medicine which is very interesting, where the data is well ahead of the clinical work, you know. So what's the other areas in terms of treatment, medication, disease-modifying therapies, actually don't do a very good job. You know, some of the studies, or most of the studies, show no effect. Some recent studies show mild effects, but when you look at the details of those studies, the effect size is really tiny. And they're not based on randomized control trials. They're based on observational studies, so poorer quality studies. So studies like ENLIGHTEN are going to become really important, because that's a study designed to look at cognitive processing speed. So pharmacology is not the best approach. Exercise is an up-and-coming area where there is some preliminary data, although the data, again, is not strong yet. But cognitive rehabilitation actually has very good data, and I urge all clinicians to find a way to have to prescribe your patient cognitive rehabilitation where you are. I realize this can be a challenge, but it's what the patients need.
Next up, you're going to hear from Dr. Shuvra Roy, a clinical fellow at Johns Hopkins University, who shared his findings from a study assessing the ability of an EHR-incorporated MS smart form to cut down on the time it takes for physicians to review MS patient history. Here's Dr. Roy with his thoughts.
You know, this is a project that we developed at Johns Hopkins University, myself and Dr. Ellen Mowry, who spearheaded the project. You know, the reason that we put this together was really to address one of the major challenges of taking care of a patient with MS, and that's the complexity of their care. When you see a patient with MS, there is a lot you need to keep track of: relapse history, what medications they've been on, why they've switched therapies in the past, how their MRIs have looked, and it's a lot to dig through and can take a lot of time for every clinic visit. So, what we did was try to, one, streamline that process, and two, try to standardize that information. So we created something called the MS Smart Form, which is available through Epic as well as in Cerner. And what it does is it contains information about a patient's diagnosis, about whether they've started to develop progressive disease. You can put in information about what relapses they've had, where their lesions have been. You can put in information about what medications they've been on, why they've switched therapies, how long they've been on those therapies, as well as what their MRIs have shown, including which ones of them have had no new lesions and which ones have developed new lesions and where those might be. And because it's so much information, it can take so long to review that without the chance to just, put it all in one place. And having it all there, I think, really, really helps the provider. I think with the EHR, so often, certainly I feel this way at times, that physicians feel like they're fighting the EHR and feeling like they're fighting through different processes just to be able to take care of patients. And our goal was to try to make it into a real tool for providers. And so the idea is, now when you open a patient's chart and you can go to their smart form, you can know their entire MS history within really just a few minutes of just knowing, okay, when was their last MRI? When are they due for a repeat? You know, what medications are they on? What are they on currently? Okay, I know what I should be checking in terms of labs. And our goal with this, honestly, as much as, you know, being a research tool, really is to get it out there for anyone. And so that's why we went through the EHR. So it's actually available for free for anyone using Epic. And then also with Cerner, we can help coordinate that as well, where you can just get this built into your practice without having to pay or really do anything extra. We're happy to help do that. But our goal is to standardize care for patients with MS across the country, and we felt going through the EHR and really the largest EHRs was the best way to do that.
Finally, we're going to close things out with a snippet of our conversation with Dr. Tanuja Chitnis, the director of the Mass General Brigham Pediatric MS Center, who spoke about the findings that she presented on a case study of ferolimab in a patient with non-active secondary progressive MS. Here's Dr. Chitnis.
The background to this study is that anti-CD3 given nasally was first tested in animal models of EAE or multiple sclerosis by Mayo et al., and this was published in Brain in 2016. And they showed that this reduced microglial activation as well as astrocyte inflammation in the brains of these animal models, and it reduced progressive disease in the animal model. And so that was really the basis of why we thought that anti-CD3 would work. I completed a phase one study about 2 years ago, and here we tested three different doses of ferolimab, which is a human anti-CD3 antibody. And we tested the three doses. They were found to be safe in healthy controls. And so then we decided to move to secondary progressive multiple sclerosis patients, and this is where the need really is. And we were able to recruit a patient who had inactive secondary progressive MS, and under an expanded access protocol that was approved by the FDA, we gave him ferolimab three times a week for a period of 2 weeks and then 1 week of rest, which constitutes a 3 week cycle of treatment. And so we gave these cycles of treatment for 6 months in total. There was some breaks in between. And we were able to show that it reduced microglial activation on PET imaging. And this is using the fluorodeoxynated PBR06 ligand, which attaches to or targets the TSPO molecule. And this is present on astrocytes and microglia in the CNS. And so we showed a reduction of this PET signal of activated microglia at the 3 month time point after 3 months of treatment, and then as well after 6 months of treatment. And this was across different areas of the brain, and this was in collaboration with Dr. Tarun Singhal, who is also at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. We also looked at inflammatory biomarkers in the blood, and here we used a very sensitive proteomic assay, and we evaluated different cytokines, and we found that ferolimab treatment in this patient reduced IL-6 levels, IL-1 beta, and IL-18 levels. And also, I think it's important to just note that safety-wise, the patient has been doing very well, and there have been no issues on treatment. He's tolerated the treatment very well, no adverse events. We've been monitoring his laboratory tests very carefully. We've also been doing ear, nose, and throat evaluations every 3 weeks, and those have all been normal. So that's really heartening. And the patient feels stable and somewhat improved, and we've seen that his motor scores, his pyramidal scores, have improved on treatment. So we're encouraged by that, and he's received over 6 months of treatment now and is doing well.
thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.